raise your hands all up in the air.
So this kind of tells a lot of different stories. There's video game commercials, there's pictures of people's collections, there's cosplayers, there's MTV videos that kind of show the culture at the time when video gaming was really new. We got the guys from Mega 64 to give us some videos to show here. It's kind of a hodgepodge of stuff, but you could sit in this lobby without ever having paid to be in the museum. You could sit in here for probably 3 or 4 hours and never see all the content on the video. So we're pretty happy. We think it's kind of a fun spot to start. The other thing about the lobby that's cool is this belies what type of a museum this really is. This suggests a minimal sort of a thing, right? There's nothing really going on the walls. Although the sculpture is very busy, the rest of it is pretty minimal. And you're playing this classical music. It's very, somber and classy. And then you turn the corner and get to the museum, and all of a sudden it's mayhem. It's what video gaming is.
When I first walked in here, I remarked that the music sort of... somebody's waving at the door, by the way.
Oh.
Just keep it rolling.
Good morning.
Hello.
So as I was saying on our video interview, this is Wolfgang, by the way.
Hi. Hi,
Rick.
It's sort of like when you walk into... not necessarily a museum, but if you walk into like a movie theater or some kind of, or like a Disneyland, kind of like you walk into a ride and there's this theatrical music playing and then you get into the actual ride where you go up and down.
Yeah. Yeah, we thought about making this place very busy, but then when we saw how it kind of turned out, we're like, this is kind of cool. You start out in a place that's very serene and I don't know, not very busy. Into a place that's extremely busy and noisy.
So where would we go first?
So you'd probably buy your tickets first, yeah. Right? Most people would step up to the ticket window here and get your ticket. And then this is what you would be greeted with as you walk in. You would have Mario ahead of you. That's a custom sculpted Mario statue. One of the things that we'll talk about is that we had 7 local artists do all of the walls and this particular sculpture. So that's one of those pieces, first thing that you see. And, of course, the thing that I always wanted when you first walked in is to see Pong. In some way, larger-than-life Pong, and that's the larger-than-life Pong.
It is larger-than-life.
Yes, if I'm standing at the Pong, you get a better idea of the scale. So 2 people can very easily and comfortably stand side-by-side and play Pong together. We chose Atari's Pong, not because that version of Pong on the screen is so memorable. Most people are like, wait, Pong was never in color. Well, Atari's Pong Arcade was. What's wrong? Did I turn it off?
No, I just put it into hold, just in case.
Okay.
That way, if you hit the button, it doesn't go.
Okay. The Atari Pong Arcade is black and white, and that, of course, came out way earlier. That was 1972. But the home console for Atari was almost an afterthought and didn't come out until 1975, long after many other companies have developed Pong-type systems for the home.
So here we have so you have all the different Pong variations, or many of them. And in front here we have the brown box Ralph Baer prototype. There it is. That's the start of it all.
Yes, it's a reproduction of the prototype that Ralph Baer used to develop what would eventually become the Magnavox Odyssey, which was to be the first home video game system. which we do have up there in its retail version.
Yes. The puppy Pong. I've always wanted to see that up close and in person.
Yeah, those puppy Pong and Dr. Pong were used in offices and dental spot, you know, places, and places where kids would get bored, that they thought this would be a nice way to kind of keep them occupied or maybe even want to show up. So, and then the selection of Pongs that we chose here is somewhat random. It was done more aesthetically. We just tried to pick the ones that kind of had their own weird look or feel to them.
Yeah, I think that's the better choice.
Yeah, so
see, the ones with the steering wheels and the grips and stuff like that, yeah.
And the wood grain,
right?
You know, and the funky colors. You know, there's way too many of them that were just plain brown or black. I guess two things that are kind of interesting on this display is that Nintendo's first game consoles were Pong systems too.
Yeah.
And the three of those are up here. The Racing 112 up top, TV Game 15 in the middle, and the Block Kazushi, which is the sort of yellowish one on the bottom by Pong. So those were, you know, not developed in the U.S., but kind of interesting early Nintendo efforts. And the other one that's by that Nintendo one that's called, you probably got to get close to it to see it, called NASA Pong, was donated to us. That was actually, if you lived in South America, that was Pong for you. Everybody had that particular Pong. In fact, that's they thought NASA Pong, was the first Pong. Because some clever person decided to create something like that and make it available all over there. So the guy who designed that, his son donated NASA Pong, that particular NASA Pong, to the museum.
He's
here.
Oh, he's here.
Yeah, somewhere. Okay, so this is the only piece of the whole museum that's really chronology based.
All right.
We wanted to show the beginning in the beginning, but everything else is kind of free form, but they are broken down into stages. So if you look at stage two, which we call timeline, is a timeline of consoles. It's 50 game systems that were released in North America. They're not all of the game systems that were released in North America, but they are either the most popular or the ones with the most interesting stories. And then each of these three digital stations has a version of the physical timeline in digital form, which does have all of the other systems that aren't included here. So you won't see a Tandy Memorex VIS on the wall, but if you wanted to learn about Tandy's Memorex VIS, you could still come here and select it. And each of these systems has this sort of info sheet that tells you about the system and how much it cost when it came out and when and how many were sold and how many games were made for it and what the popular ones were and the not-so-popular ones and the rare ones. So you get a little bit of everything if you weren't sure, you know, about a game system. Or I owned that game system when I was in high school. And people will walk up to this and pick that and sort of refresh their memories about
whatever it is. Yeah, this setup is fantastic. I mean, I remember when I saw it at home, when I saw the gigantic SNES controller, I was like, wow, that's like the perfect aesthetic to have. And the other thing is, I mean, some people may not realize this, but there's three different setups here, which, you know, you might look at and say, what's the big deal? But I think a lot of museums would never have thought of putting multiple. They would just, this is a pain, let's just do one. So that
we didn't want one person to be standing there with a line behind them.
But I'm saying most museums, if they had an interactive thing like this, would only have one.
Yeah.
And you have to wait in line or you just walk past it because, you know, who wants to wait?
Well, this was a really important exhibit for us because it's sort of the glossary to the whole rest of the museum. You can always come back here after you've seen something and say, what was that again? And come back here and get the information that you need on any of those systems.
Yeah. All right.
And it goes all the way up to the current generation, too. So there's no... We didn't leave anybody out.
Who's that signed by there?
The Xbox One is Major Nelson's Xbox One, the very first unboxed Xbox One, at least publicly unboxed.
And this is some of the artwork. This is amazing.
Yeah, so like I had said before, all of the art that was done in here was done by local artists. It's kind of interesting because we only had one wall in mind when we started looking for artists. And it's the wall that sits outside of a classroom that we built. And we wanted to have Mario pipes on the doors. So we wanted somebody to do a Mario mural on that wall. Mm. At the time, Frisco Arts was sharing this building with us. Frisco Arts has lots of artists, contact with artists. So we asked the woman in charge, can you send out a message that we're looking for a muralist to handle this Mario mural that we want to do? Well, she posted it, and as it turns out, one of the people in Frisco Arts is Valerie Wigglesworth, who writes for the Dallas Morning News, and who decided, I'm going to put that call out in the newspaper. And later that day, there were hundreds of emails from artists interested in doing a mural. So we brought them in here in big groups and told them what these white walls, what we envisioned in the area, like what we were trying to do with that space. And they essentially all pitched us their ideas, and we picked the ones that we liked the best. And we really couldn't be happier. But a lot of what you see with the art is almost a happy accident. We hadn't really planned on doing much more than putting our own things up here, posters and display cases. But I think the artwork actually lends much more of a uniqueness to the museum.
So the other thing I love is, obviously, you've got these little setups here for each game console. But I love the TVs. I mean, I know that they're retail, but just it's cool that they have that... that like 80s look to them.
Yeah, right. They're a little stylish, and they're decent. They're decent monitors.
You got the bar stools down here.
Yeah, and this is all changeable too. Like we plan on having and we've already done it many times. The games change weekly, but the game systems can also change, you know, as needed. So if we wanted to do tournaments, we could do tournaments where we put 10 of the same game system in there and run a tournament. Stage three is third party. So this is homage to all the companies that have made games for game systems that aren't the game system developer. So it's the games that aren't made by Microsoft and Nintendo and Sony, but by companies that had a very significant role in the future and the development of video games and in the future of video games now. So we started out with highlights for companies like Electronic Arts and Activision and Infocom and Comavid, all of which we considered to be sort of unique or groundbreaking. And then we spent a lot of the rest of the time filling this space out with what did those developers use to make this stuff happen.
Yeah, so you've got prototypes here. You've got the dev kits, dev stations, which is, again, I think it's amazing because, you know, you guys have this stuff, but it's great because I think a lot of people, if they were doing a museum, would think, well, I'll just, like, here, there's a Sega CD dev console over there, but most people just say, I'll just set up a Sega CD.
Just right, without showing
retail
how...
one,
yeah.
But you've got the actual, you know, development model there.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to show things in this museum that you wouldn't be able to see anywhere else. So a lot of these things were given to us by developers over the years because we had this traveling museum and they wanted things to be taken care of, or they were going to throw them away. Aha! So we couldn't allow that. So, you know, we grabbed as much of it as we could and took care of it, and now we have a space specifically for those things. So these guys that designed games that have kept some of the things that they used to design those games, we can now make available to the public.
Yeah, we're doing kind of a quick walkthrough, which doesn't do it justice, unfortunately.
But. You could come back for your B-roll later. And we're also doing this when there's nobody in the museum because we haven't opened yet. So.
Wow. American Automation.
That whole setup on the bottom, that is just one desktop station for a Nintendo developer for the NES. Those were the pieces. It's not even a complete set. It's bigger than that. But that set is for designing NES cartridges from your desktop. And then we tried to keep everything interactive. So again, we chose three systems that were important in the generation of third party. So Atari 2600, where it all began, NES, where the lockout chip sort of created challenges for developers, and the Xbox 360, where for the first time we as gamers could actually develop our own games. So,
and like everything else, if you see it and it's open, it's playable.
Yep. Very hands-on experience here. Speaking of hands-on, So this wall of controllers is by no means meant to be a definitive view of the controllers of history. It's meant to be more of, look at all of the shit that we played with over the years. Isn't it weird? Isn't it funny? Isn't it practical? How did it all start? And then, of course, we were a little creative, or I should say at least one of our artists was. I can't remember exactly who came up with the idea to make this a Galaga backdrop, but essentially the controllers become the, you know, the bad guys
right,
in this
yeah.
armada. And, of course, the worst bad guy of all is getting blown up.
Oh, come on. The 5200's not that bad. It's not that bad. It is bad, but it's...
we put little touches of our personality in here, and that was one of them. We wanted to show one of them getting blown up, right? It's Galaga. And maintenance hasn't been in yet. That shouldn't be sitting there like that. So, also part of having everything hands-on is this was set up in a way that people could reach and touch them and
yeah.
you know, maneuver them, but you know, you could also yank them off the wall. So we're sort of working out that fine balance between, you know, how close can you get and how much can you touch it. But for now, so far so good.
And we got some third-party stuff here, most of which were absolutely useless, but yet people bought them, unfortunately.
Yeah, and kind of fun. And I don't know if you caught this, but the purpose of this interactive piece of it is that we rotate some interesting controller that you probably never got to try before.
Yeah.
Over time, I think we had the lace stick out here when we opened up, and we changed it to the fishing controller. This doesn't really have a stage number, it's just sort of an attraction within the museum. So Easter eggs, as gamers, we all know what they are. They're an important part of gaming for all of us. We look for Easter eggs in games all the time. Now they're, you know, there's glitches and bugs and all kinds of fun things to keep people occupied. But we kind of start with the one that was most popular or that made Easter
yes.
eggs popular with Adventure. Yes. We actually have a custom cartridge that is greatly makes it easier to do the whole thing.
right,
so we
yeah.
basically put the dot right there for you to find it. And,
be there all
and
day.
We gave you instructions to do it. But this exhibit itself is actually a game.
Ah.
So within the museum, we've hidden 30 different Easter eggs. They're things that are in a place that they don't belong. Like you should recognize, like, why would the NVM name be on that spot in this particular place? So you could come in here, you log in your initials like you would on any arcade game. It picks 9 at random, and then you have to try to find those 9 in the museum. And it times you, and there's a high scoreboard.
Museum of cheating here.
Museum of cheats.
So this is sort of like if the Cooperstown had a steroid wing, which some
yep.
people suggest. Here you go.
Yep, there it is.
Where to? Oh,
right.
Portable.
This room is really hard to get a good handle on in video or in pictures because, first of all, the artwork is our mascot Blip. But this is a forced perspective piece of art in that when you walk in, you see the picture the way it's supposed to be seen. But once you're inside, it is extremely distorted.
And I have to remark that at the top here is the greatest of all time, the Lynx, as Frankie would attest to.
right? And the second greatest, the Gizmondo.
Oh, wow. I don't know that.
So step in. There's a whole... sort of a little bit of a historical thing. This one's a little bit chronological.
Right, so now we have Game & Watches down there, and some other ones. These look like a lot of imports.
Yeah, this case
Pokemon.
Was telling the story of how Nintendo's Game Boy, if you read the cards and sort of did it in order, the story that's being told is Game Boy essentially took over the handheld gaming world, and
right.
lots of other people tried to get a piece of that, but ultimately they just became sort of casualties, and most of them people don't even remember. But we do. We never forget at National Video Game Museum.
And I love this, that you actually have them playable here. This Pac-Man Coleco playable. There's the other Coleco. Wow.
where to next?
So this whole hall, you might want to get a quick look at the whole hall. So the whole hall is telling a story of how the industry crashed at the end of 1983 and how computers sort of kept the gaming alive in the United States until Mario comes along in 1985. So this is a depressed game store about to go out of business. And if you take the time to read it, believe me, a lot of people walk up to here and they want to buy that Vectrex and those games in the bargain bin because it's a pretty authentic looking store.
Not for sale?
No. So if you read all these cards, it tells you the story about how a store like this
tried
to stay alive, but despite all of the problems of the time, like games that suck and companies that were making games that shouldn't have been, and overproduced and overpriced games like E.T., etc. And of course, now adding to that, and probably in my opinion, the biggest factor, computers becoming very affordable and playing great games, sort of made people think, why do I need a game console at all? So that story is all being told here.
So and of course, you have all the computers set up, many of which I have not seen in probably 30 years working, to be honest.
Yep. Everything works. Everything. In a lot of cases in these, we gave people the opportunity to try to figure out how to load a game or change the game. We put instructions on them in case they get frustrated, which we often did back then. Like this one, this Commodore 64 drive with its...
Yuck.
Well, I have a 1541 Ultimate.
Yeah. Things are a lot easier nowadays. But did it get any more complicated than this? So in order to just get that good of a game, you had to load off of a cassette tape. So you had to wait for this for 3 or 4 minutes and then run it, and then that's what you got to play. So.
Donkey Kong Live!
Again, this stuff changes over time. Games change regularly. Computers will change, you know, every couple of months because we want people to come in and see something different. And we have a lot more than what's out. So this particular wall here is showing you the computers that were add-ons to a game console. The great ideas that the game industry had for making their consoles into more than just a console and trying to keep up with the computer market. None of these ideas were particularly good.
They're so big. Oh, there's a kiosk from the Digital Press store.
Yep, made the trip. Still gets used every day. And this is kind of an interesting... So this is the restrooms.
Yes.
So the restroom area is the final scene from Dragon's Lair. And again, pretty hard to capture on video and pictures, but if you're standing in that corner, you are standing in that very last scene where Dirk is about to grab the magic sword and kill the dragon and take the key and unlock Daphne's bubble. So all that is right in that little space as you do a little 360. Our Dragon's Lair machine is currently not in order, but we're getting close. It needs a monitor. We're almost there. And this idea was actually Liz's idea, my wife Liz. We were trying to come up with what is a good themed thing, and we'd already kind of played out Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man, and we didn't want to do another Mario because we already have Mario right next door, and we knew we were going to need that. So we had this Dragon's Lair poster sitting on the floor for the longest time, just figuring out where we were going to hang it. She said, why don't you do that? You've got the guy and the girl right there. So it was a perfect... really perfect for this spot.
Yeah, this is another spot I think Frankie will have to come to pay his respects. Dragon's Lair.
Frankie was one of the first people that I shared this picture. Like as we were building this, and it wasn't even done yet, I was sending him pictures because I knew he'd really get a kick out of it.
I'm sure he can't wait to take a dump in the Dragon's Lair bathroom.
This room, which is almost finished, I can show it to you if you want, is a classroom. So it's a classroom where we'll do workshops and lectures and things for kids and things for adults. So we can have Friday night at the movies in here. We can do, you know, pizza parties and late night pre-arcade festivities. I will show you because you should get a preview of it. This will probably be the first time it's seen anywhere because it doesn't open up until mid-July. So we got our furniture, we have a sink, and then there's this really cool, subtle, it's pretty subtle, maybe it's very in your face, I don't know. We tried to make this one a little more subtle. It's all sorts of programmy type stuff,
yeah.
Circuit boardy type stuff, but the concept is, what are all the things that are needed to make a game? Yeah. And it ends with a mural of Solid Snake, sort of halfway done, completed, somewhat rendered.
Right.
So this will be a fun room when it's done.
Okay, 14 minutes.
Okay. Well, we're more than halfway done.
So here we've got the create area.
Yeah, so designed in the spirit of Minecraft, and the story here is about game designers that have given us as gamers the opportunity to build within the game. So Minecraft being probably the most popular today, people, but there have been lots of games. Like, you remember all of these ones that Electronic Arts used to make, the pinball construction and racing destruction. Doom was the first game that really, well, it wasn't the first, but it was one of the first and most popular to allow you to design your own levels, all built within the game itself. And then others like Mario Maker and Mario Paint that kind of let you do your own design.
Yeah. That was it. It was all about mods. PC gaming was all about mods. It's spent a lot of time on that stuff.
And more so now than ever, really.
Well, now you sells can create games. An entire game that is a mod.
Yep. This one, not as good on camera, I think, as it is, you know, to experience it yourself, but this tributary to music and environment, like sound effects and music and games. So the concept here is that this game has no sound whatsoever. It's very difficult to play the game with no sound, especially a game like Parappa the Rapper. Mm-hmm. This one's just the music from the game, which would kind of suck, I think, if you just picked up Parappa the Rapper soundtrack and didn't know the game. And then the game the way it's meant to be played, where it all comes together and makes a lot of sense. So we've rotated games in and out of here, too, that kind of show you that impact that sound and environment has. And we also have this cool app that Elisa from New Jersey wrote for us, which has both a jukebox that kind of gives you history of important game music, but also has this cool generations thing where you can hear, and you're not going to be able to do it, but you can hear a popular game theme as it would sound on other game consoles.
Ah.
So everyone knows Sonic the Hedgehog from the Sega Genesis. Actually, maybe I can plug this. Okay, good. So you can kind of hear the Genesis version of it, but then if you tap over, this is using the Super Nintendo sound chips, and then how it might sound if it were on a 2600.
It's doable. Somebody made a homebrew.
It's cool.
Sonic, so
Elisa did that.
All right.
So the only non-interactive exhibit, and this is meant to change over time, but our launch was, what does a developer's office look like? Specifically, it's our partner, Randy Pitchford, who helped get us into Frisco in the first place. Like, he was moving his business, Gearbox, from Plano to Frisco and already knew some of the players in the city and was able to get us audience with them and pitch our product. So we thought, well, he's moved his office. What did his office look like, and what kind of a story can we tell? We haven't really finished this yet. This is supposed to have all sorts of little pop-ups that tell you who is he meeting with today, and what's on his computer, and why did he win this award, and so on. So.
Or the prototype.
Those who that have been to Classic Gaming Expo over the years, or many of our traveling exhibits, will recognize a lot of what's in here. We used to put these in display cases and tour the country with them, these pre-production games. This exhibit tells the story about how online gaming has changed, how it's changed gaming for us, and how it's changed the way we play.
So what do the little levers do?
So the concept here is that you would select a year on the lever, and that would replicate what the speed of a transmission would be like in that era. And then you could type a message or you could send a webcam picture and it'll send a little light in that speed, and when the light gets to the other side, you've got it.
1962, you're going to be here all day.
We didn't make it excruciating.
No.
And of course, the first time you get on, you're treated to this familiar sound.
Yeah. Awful. Is it?
So yeah, if you pick sort of a middle year like this and you type a message.
I just want to download a picture of Pamela Anderson.
And you hit enter. This is replicating what that speed would be like. It's more like an analogy, really, because what it does is 2001 is as fast as it can go, and 1962 is as slow as it can go. So we're kind of showing you the different speeds between. It's in no way a scientific reproduction. And then some more collection stuff. This is that mural that originally we knew we needed. We wanted this all along, something like this. So this was done by our pal Oliver Wade, who also designed the Blip character, who is our mascot. But again, a lot of the stuff you've seen at Classic Gaming Expo, we would travel all over the place with these pieces. And this is right about where you start to get into the real museum-y stuff. This portal, if you know the game Portal, do you remember seeing?
Yeah.
So you know where the other portal is. A lot of times people see this, they didn't notice the other one when they walked in. Which is great, because you see it. Yeah, you see it when you walk out. So this is the museum-y section. It's just called the checkpoint in the museum. It's not one of our stages. There's no story being told here. It's just a random selection of things that we think are cool or interesting and didn't fit any of the other exhibits. So, again, a lot of things that you've seen at CG over the years and a lot of things that you haven't, because many of these things were in our personal collections and didn't get traveled around a lot. And we have a lot more, so these things will also rotate significantly over time. And we have a couple of good showcase-type display cases, so it was kind of cool to lay out all the Nintendo 64 DD. We'll finally be able to show the RDI Halcyon and its completeness in one place. Stage 12. We just needed a little nook to do this in, but we thought it would be kind of cool to see that this is sort of the changeover between the world of board games and the world of computer games, which still happens today. But it was a really, really big phenomena for a while there when arcade games were getting popular and board game manufacturers were trying to figure out a way to keep people interested. So they did these crossovers, which are really fun. And then a little bit more museum-y stuff. Just because we had a little bit of extra wall to fill, we didn't want to leave a space open. So this particular case is all stuff from Japan. A lot of people ask, like, where is all your... Why don't you have things from Europe and Japan? And there's so many cool things that came out there. And we remind them that this is the National Video Game Museum. So we wanted to put, especially with the amount of space that we have available, which isn't a lot, we wanted to make sure that we really gave the emphasis to the U.S. gaming. Or at least North America. So we did dedicate one entire display case to Japan. And then the snapshots in time. Best remembered because Len Herman didn't like them.
Okay.
But the concept here is that this was the first time in history where mom allowed the television set to be used for a video game system. And the first time Mario was seen in a bedroom somewhere in the U.S. So you've got something like 1980 in the living room and something like 1987 in the bedroom. And our guests get a kick out of this. If you're not into video gaming, a kid's mom who comes in here never, never fails to walk through here with a big smile on her face.
There you go, members or dad. Only.
And we've even put things in the drawers and the cabinets that are specific to the era. So there's lots of sort of Easter eggs and little hidden surprises as you explore these rooms. And again, they're meant to be interactive. Like, we want to see a family sitting here playing in television. We want to see the kid and his dad or grandpa sitting here with the kid shooting at Duck Hunt. And we do. We pretty often do see big groups in here kind of lounging. Oh, 15. So we saw a little bit of homage to Ralph Baer when we first walked in. This is a little bit more of an homage to Ralph Baer. This was designed using 640 Rubik's Cubes.
Wow.
So we did this with a group. There's a local school called Southern Methodist University, and one of the professors there basically volunteered his skills, most of them engineering skills, in getting this thing made for us. So we now have a program where we could take pretty much any image, turn it into Rubik's Cube colored things, and then be able to create the pattern by which to build a mural. So this stuff was all laid out on the floor at one point on paper, where the kids would just set up the one face of the Rubik's Cube and lay it down on the paper the way it's supposed to look, and then when we were done, it all just went into the case. It's really cool. It was a fun project. This is another area of Dracula from Castlevania X. Castlevania 2, actually. It's a 360 version of it, but it's a cool statue, right?
Yeah.
We remember seeing this at E3. We were actually right next to Konami the year that this was displayed, and we couldn't get our hands on this statue. We actually had to buy it from a collector years later, but we were glad to finally be able to get it. It's also something you can't tell from here, but from the entrance you can see it, which is kind of cool. It's sort of brooding in the distance. And then this area, which is a... this is a flexible, we call this a flexibit. These will probably all come out at some point, these kiosks, and we'll be able to do all sorts of different things here when it's Sonic's birthday or the anniversary of Crash Bandicoot or Sony has some major product. We'll be able to basically move all of this stuff out and use this pretty big space for, you know, special exhibits. Okay, so you
in
got
the arcade.
Right, so you got your 80s replica arcade, complete with our own local scoreboard, which now has names everywhere. These are real scores from real local people. Some of them are actually really good scores. The Dig Dug score was done by a kid, he's 10 years old, rolled Dig Dug over. So we did the whole thing, black lights, neon sign, 80s music, and 40 classic arcade cabinets, most of which work. Hubert's Cubes are still booting up. Rally X booted up eventually. Yeah, and again, we had a little bit of space and figured we got to do something with it. We thought about putting a tabletop type arcade, but usually tabletops get sat on, and we didn't want that either. So we had a lot of arcade relevant character stuff, so we put it in this display case. Again, all the art in here was original. Like, that's not a centipede from back in the day. That was painted by one of our local artists, Ron Martin. All right, I think we got most of the classics covered. Like, the popular ones are in here. Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, Defender, Centipede, Missile Command, Dig Dug, Frogger, Donkey Kong.
So, as we wrap up, congratulations, Joe. You've made it happen.
Thank you. It's been fun. It's been a fun project. It's we're still tweaking. We got a lot of work to do, but we're open to the public. The public seems to really enjoy it. And we're expecting really good things here in the future.
I was down for a minute.
Oh, good. Good timing.
Not the battery, it's just the memory card.